Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Close Up Talk Radio, the unique internet broadcast series that brings you together with some of the most amazing, important, and interesting individuals from the worlds of business, industry, travel, art, and entertainment. From company owners, CEOs, and presidents, to the technical wizards behind the scenes who create the magic that make their company's products and services so special. Here's your opportunity to hear firsthand the fascinating stories of how it all happened from those who actually made it possible. This is Close Up Talk Radio.
Good afternoon, everyone. This is your host, Jim Masters, and we're live worldwide on Close Up Talk Radio. It is 12 noon Eastern here on Tuesday, April 22nd, 2014. And thank you so much for joining us. It is terrific having you with us here on the program. And we have a really terrific program as we continue our series with Richard Hoffman. He is director of Chatsworth Pavilion. And if you've heard our previous episodes, and we do invite you to go back into our archives to hear some of the wonderful conversation we've had thus far with Richard. It is really amazing material, and it might become very helpful for you or a loved one, a friend, a colleague, somebody that you know who might be struggling and dealing with an addiction, various types of addiction, whether it be drugs or alcohol, gambling or sexual addiction. You know, all addictions begin as solutions. Chatsworth Pavilion is an amazing place located in Montreal, Canada. And, you know, when you talk about addiction, sometimes people aren't really sure how to define what they are, how to determine when it is an addiction. We're going to talk a little bit about that. We'll sort of dissect what an addiction is. We'll talk more about Chatsworth Pavilion and why it's so important. And quite interesting, I was just talking to Richard just prior in prep for the show, and he mentioned that a great deal of the clients who come to visit their great location in Montreal come from the United States, as well as, of course, Europe as well. So quite interesting, you know. And as I said, whether it is drugs, alcohol, gambling, or sex, all addictions do begin as solutions. You might not necessarily think of it that way, but, you know, there's stress reducers. In order for a successful recovery process to actually take root, the fundamental emotional need served by this behavior must first be addressed. As Richard has mentioned, recovery is a process, not an event. As the director of Chatsworth Pavilion, he says you have to replace their addiction with a way of living that allows them to better manage their stress without turning to self-medication. Chatsworth Pavilion is an addiction rehabilitation center that's truly known for its unique three-week residential recovery program, which maximizes treatment by making the group a central component of treatment. According to Richard, the most important component to any therapeutic modality is therapeutic alliance, the trust and bond between peers and patients and the therapeutic team. Now, over 21 days, residents develop trust. Trust is essential and is very important. Once trust is developed, movements can be made in the right direction to positivity. They realize their secrets and shames aren't so unique. And the other members of the group are listening and empathizing as well, which is also very important in the process. They see a similarity in the experiences. Chatsworth supplements its residential program with a robust outpatient aftercare program as well that's designed to dramatically improve their chances for continued recovery. And Richard has outlined as well for us that it's truly critical for Chatsworth residents to continue with therapy. Accountability is essential, and when accountability is set up properly, it increases folks' chances of success. Let's welcome back Chatsworth Pavilion Director Richard Hoffman to Close Up Talk Radio. I just want to make mention as well, you can follow along with us or maybe right after the show for more information. Feel free to peruse their tremendous website, which is chatsworthpavilion.com. Again, chatsworthpavilion.com. It's an amazing website, and it's one initial step you can take to finding out more about this tremendous facility that has done such good for so many. You know, it's just one of those types of places that creates magic in so many different ways in helping people through the struggles of their lives when it comes to addiction. Richard, welcome back to Close Up Talk Radio. It's always great to have you with us, and thanks for joining us on the show today. We appreciate it.
Nice to be back. Thank you.
Absolutely. Tell us about addictions in terms of breaking it down, and what an addiction, in case somebody didn't hear the previous show or this is, again, their first time tuning in, what an addiction really is, and how can one really identify when whatever it is that they are, you know, involved with is actually addiction? Is there a trigger point? Is there a level that you reach where it actually becomes like, an aha moment, a red flag comes up, and addiction, how do you really break that down?
Well, in the simplest terms, if you take a look at the diagnostic criteria, for instance, in the DSM, you know, they're going to give you, you know, a set of criteria. There's 9 of them, and depending on how many you relate to or can identify in your life, the severity will be there. But if you crunch this down to the elemental, you know, components of what makes an addiction addiction, the first thing that you find is a repetition of using, and it creates problems in your life, you know. So you use something and it creates a problem. You use it again, it creates another problem. You use it again and there's another problem. And that doesn't mean that every time you do it there's going to be a problem, but there comes a point when you realize that, you know, If you do the math and you connect the dots, you plus doing this activity equals a problem. And with a certain amount of repetition, you should realize that, you know, this is not doing you well. This is not good for you. But the determining point, I would think, would be that you get to a point where you know this is not good, you know you shouldn't do it, and you can't help yourself. You do it anyways. And when you get to that point where, you know, it's not your mother, your father, your brother, your sister, your husband, your wife, your boss. You yourself start realizing that, gee, you know, every time I drink too much. Every time I drink too much, it causes me some problems. I either end up spending too much money, or I drive under the influence, or it creates arguments at home or whatnot. And you realize that these problems keep occurring, and you're saying to yourself, gee, you know, maybe I should relax a little bit on this, and you're having difficulty. You're having difficulty not doing it. And it's a very simple way of looking at the dynamics of this, you know, unmanageable need, the powerlessness that is talked about in recovery, that you know you shouldn't do it, and yet you have this compulsion, you have this need to do it. And, you mentioned in the intro that it all starts with a stress reducer, right? And there's a certain profile, we believe here at Chatsworth, that there's a certain profile to a person that's going to develop addictions and dependencies. And one of the common traits is that they do not handle stress well. They don't feel good about themselves. They don't feel good about their situation in life. There's some uneasiness within them, you know, and we call this a diseased ego, you know, a person that's not at peace with themselves. And then they show up in to the buffet of life, I call it, right? So whether it be the schoolyard or, you know, social life, and they try different things, and they realize that, you know, they're a little nervous and a little tongue-tied or a little shy, or, you know, really having difficulty interacting with life, but if they have a couple of beers, if they have a couple of drinks, all of that nervousness goes away and they feel good. They feel that they can handle the situation, you know? And so you realize how at the very beginning of the process, whatever it is that the person turns to will seem as a solution, you know? So it could be alcohol, it could be drugs, it could be cigarettes, nicotine, it could be chocolate cake, you know. We often talk about, when we talk about food, you know, we often talk about comfort food, right? We've all heard that expression, you know, comfort food makes you feel good, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
So what happens is the person shows up to the buffet of life and they experiment with different, you know, things that they can incorporate into their life, whether it be alcohol or drugs or food or sex or gambling, high-risk behavior, and they realize that when they're doing it, they feel better. And that then develops a psychological dependence on it. But beyond the psychological dependence, there's also a physiological difference with alcoholics, with addicts, you know. And the way the brain chemistry works is that this component that we introduce in our lives comes and helps us manage our stress. It helps manage our fears. It helps manage our insecurities. And so we develop a dependence on it. But we have to make a difference between dependence and addiction. So, for instance, if a person would do, let's say, heroin, you know, let's take a real powerful drug. A person does heroin, they might develop, and they probably will develop, a physiological dependence. In other words, if they don't want to feel the pain of withdrawal, they need to continue using. That's a dependence. But it is not everyone that is therefore a heroin addict, because there's going to be people that you detox, you get them off of heroin, you help them go through the detox in a managed way, and then they're actually happy to be off of it, and they're going to have a very easy time never going back to it. But there's the other group of people where even if you detox them and you get them off the heroin and, you know, they have a couple of months of not using, something within them compels them to go back. And that's the need to medicate. And that's when we realize we really have an addict on our hands. When it is not the fear or the fear of the pain of withdrawal or the fear of pain of not using that's compelling them to use, but it really is the psychological need to medicate an emotional dis-ease within themselves. So what we look for always is, you know, what problems has it caused in your life? Because obviously the person will have to come to grips with the idea that this is not a good idea. And oddly enough, most human beings do what they do because they think it's a good idea. And the addict will find all sorts of rationalizations and all sorts of justifications. But eventually, if they are helped to address the fact that, hey, this is causing some serious problems in your life and you keep doing it,
yeah,
there's obviously an issue, right?
Yeah,
and
right.
Then... And then the person says, okay, well, you know what? Thank you for bringing it to my attention. I'm not going to do it anymore. And they think they've resolved their situation.
Right.
But what they find out is that there's this need to medicate within them that unless it's properly addressed and the solution is presented and properly supported, they will go back to using. And that's when you really appreciate what addiction is, that it's this compulsion within a person to medicate, to go to this external element to help bring well-being within themselves. Now, that's the hope, but the reality is that it just brings more problems, you know?
And I imagine, too, with certain types of addictions, the feeling of being in control and being powerful, especially maybe with a gambling addiction or sexual addiction, the feeling of the one being in control and I can win and I can, you know, if I just, you know, throw the dice one more time, I can really nail it and just let me give one more shot at it, you know, I can really score and I can really do this, that type of thing. Power struggle within oneself and maybe feeling like they don't have much control of anything else in their life, or maybe growing up they were always shot down all the time and this gives them the feeling of control, and you know, if I just take that one more jump and one more chance, I'll get that, you know, and I'll bet the whole house just to throw that dice one more time. Or power comes in to some of this too, right? Or an assumption that you're gaining more control and power over something else.
Absolutely. And you know, at Chatsworth here, we work with a model that addresses what we call the four core addictions. And the four core addictions are security, control, sensation, and suffering. And so what we find is that people that have addictions and dependencies will need an extraordinary level of security. They're always looking for security, but they're looking for security outside of themselves. And they are attempting to have control. They're attempting to gain control, to keep control. And this exaggerated need to try to control. And when we talk about a control addiction, we're not saying that the person is successful at controlling. We're saying that the person has this unmanageable need to try to control. And that goes from anywhere from image management to security and whatnot. And then, of course, there's the sensation. They need sensations. They need the powerful sensations. And the sensations can be one of attenuating insecurities and fears. So the sensation that you get from drinking alcohol is that you're less worried, you're less concerned, your fears go out the window, your inhibitions drop, you're a little bit more gutsy, you're willing to take chances, right? Or if you do other things like cocaine or whatnot, and then you have this feeling of extraordinary power and invincibility. And the sensation that comes from gambling, oddly enough, is not from the winning or losing. It's the heightened reality while the dice are bouncing. That's the high of the gambler. The best way to appreciate it is that it all happens while the dice are still bouncing. Once they settle and you've either won or lost, it's time to roll them again because the high comes from the risk. And the risk is an incredibly inebriating reality because it makes you feel special. It makes you feel different, you know. When you take a look at speeding, for instance, driving fast, right, okay, and you ask speeders, habitual speeders, you know, are you in a hurry? Not really. Are you late? Not really. Then
yeah.
Why are you speeding, right? Why are you
yeah.
taking this risk? You know, and the risk-taking is what makes this person feel worthy. They're alive. They're special. They're not like everyone else. They don't follow the rules, you know.
Yeah, right, exactly.
And it makes them feel good about themselves. And then, you know, there's the suffering addiction. And I'm not talking about the poor suffering addict here. We're actually talking about an exaggerated need to have suffering in your life. And that is tied into the hope that someone will come to the rescue and you'll get more love and attention, and also to have an excuse for why your life is not better.
Now, that's very fascinating what you just said. I'd love to pick up on that. The need to have suffering in your life. We all think that we try to do everything we can in life to avoid as much suffering and pain as humanly possible. We'll do everything we can, but some of us actually not revel in, but we are more comfortable in a life of suffering because it brings attention to us and maybe that security we need, and others come to our aid and maybe they'll sweep up the mess and they'll comfort us and take care of things. So if we are stuck in self-suffering, we will attract some of that assistance, that help, that attention that we seem to really get a lot out of, I guess, huh? That's fascinating.
Absolutely.
That's fascinating.
If you look at a very simple dynamic, and I know this is going to sound silly, but if you take a look at procrastinating, right? Okay, a very simple activity of procrastinating. So you know that you have a goal and it has a date, a due date, and it's got to be done and you should be working on it, but you keep mm-hmm. putting it off. You keep putting it off, right? And then there's this incredible stress that builds up. You know you got to
yeah.
get it done. And then you cram and you get it done and you get it done under the wire. And you high-five yourself because, you know, you say, wow, I did it. And you actually brag to people and you say, I work better under pressure, you know?
Have you been talking to my family?
But
I call
but
myself a procrastinating perfectionist to a degree. I sometimes will, you know, because I'm involved in 50,000 things at once, doing a lot of different things. So if there's something that I know is ultra important and or something that I know once I get involved with it, and it could be anything, it could be cleaning a closet, reorganizing a closet, I will hold off until the calendar is completely open, because I know once I dive in to do that thing, I'm all or nothing. That closet is going to be completely torn apart, completely reorganized, everything, you know, neat and orderly and everything. So I throw around the phrase for myself, a procrastinating perfectionist. And it's because of wanting it to be right and not having to go back every other week and redo it and redo it or redo it. Like, I'm somebody who can't throw a lot of stuff under the bed or just throw stuff into a junk drawer, because I will know that it's there and I will feel as if I have cheated. You know, I cheated. I just threw that stuff under the bed, but I know it's under the bed. So why didn't I just take it out from under the bed and take the time to organize it, put it in the shelf, put it in the drawer, put it where it belongs, but I'll wait to do it until the time is right where I know I can block everything else out and devote all the time to it.
Yep.
That probably makes total sense to you too, doesn't it?
Well, yeah, and I understand the dynamic behind it. And now most people, of course, you know, all people on this planet, I believe, have a certain need for security, right? We all want to know that we can go to bed in peace, that the doors are locked and there's not going to be a home invasion. We like to know that we have our job waiting for us tomorrow morning, some job security, and so on and so forth. So we all need some security, just like we all need some level of control. We all need to have self-determination, if nothing else, right? To be able to choose our jobs, choose who we marry, and whatnot. And we all have a need for sensations, because we are human beings and we're sensual beings. And we also all need a certain level of suffering. It's an immunization. It's what teaches us in life that, okay, you know, not everything can work our way, and we will go through grief and sadness and losses, but we can move on, and this too shall pass. So each one of these can teach us valuable things, and all human beings have a need for all four of these, the security, the control, the sensation, and the suffering. However, what we've noticed is that when we're dealing with addicts, they have these needs at an uncontrollable, exaggerated level, you know? And yeah. when studying this suffering addiction, that more often comes across as self-sabotaging and crisis-creating. And you look at this and you say, gee, you know, isn't it amazing that most addicts have this need to somehow sabotage things when it's going well, and they love creating crises. Yeah. And you know, very often they'll say, well, it's unconscious. But on the other hand, they consciously do what needs to be done to create the crisis or to sabotage it. And so there must be something that they gain from it. They gain something from living a life that is full of crises. And what they gain is, on one hand, a certain level of self-worth. Look at what I'm going through and look what I have to put up with. And yeah. it adds to my, you know, self-esteem. Look at how much I suffer, right? But on the other hand, it also presents a wonderful excuse to excuse why it is that I haven't done better or why it is that I am, you know, suffering. And so when you combine these four together, you look at something as simple as an alcoholic for whom alcohol could give the security to be able to go talk to that young lady at the bar that's really beautiful, and he's a little shy and tongue-tied, but with a couple of beers he can
yeah.
make it happen.
Sit up. Yeah.
You know, it gives him the control. It obviously answers the need for sensation, the inebriation, the you know, the beginning, you know, the, just that little buzz, and it will eventually also give him the suffering. So these are the four core addictions that we find at the basis of it, and from there on we look at how does this person medicate in their life. And so to us here at Chatsworth, alcohol, pills, drugs, whether it be sex, sexual activities, whether it be gambling, high-risk behaviors, whether it be food or whatever else, workaholism or whatever, we look at these as medicators that come and answer this incredible need to somehow try to have control over our four core addictions. And,
workaholism.
And
That's interesting. You mentioned that one about just throwing yourself into work constantly, and there's an addiction to that as well, just the work. I've got to keep working.
Absolutely, and like any other addiction, you know, it's not measured in the amount of time that you spend at work, because if you have a single mom who goes to work 9 to 5 and then picks up the kid at the daycare and goes home and prepares dinner and prepares the kid for the night, and then grandma comes over from 8 to midnight so that mom can go to the local pharmacy to stock shelves, this is not a workaholic. This is just a poor single mom trying to make ends meet.
Survival, right? Yeah.
So workaholism, just like alcoholism, just like compulsive gambling, just like coke addiction or drug addiction, is not measured in the amount or frequency. It's measured in the exaggerated need to do it, and it's measured in the difficulty in not doing it. So when you take a look at a workaholic, this is a person who, if you ask them to go on vacation, they have a hard time. They have a hard time relaxing on a beach, doing nothing other than enjoying their time off, because they got to be in touch with the office. They got to be in control. They got to check in. And you realize that for them, work is not just a means of earning money and making a contribution to life. It really comes and satisfies a very sick need for escapism, validation. They identify with, you know, with what they do, look at how important I am, and I need to do this. I have an exaggerated need to do this, and if I don't, I feel very antsy. And that's one of the components, you know, when we help people address their addiction and to really examine whether or not there is an addiction in their life, one of the components is to always, you know, help them assess, how easy are you not doing it? You know, how easy is it for you to not do it?
And
when you realize that so much of your emotional well-being and stability is tied in to the possibility of doing it, whatever it is, then you realize that there is a dependence. And so you're getting something from it, you know?
From it.
And,
yeah. Amazing. We're speaking with Richard Hoffman, director of Chatsworth Pavilion in Montreal, Canada. The website is chatsworthpavilion.com. And Richard, that really is, we've got maybe a little less than 2 minutes already. This is a fascinating conversation. I can't wait to chat with you more next week. But the website is a really good starting point for people to learn more and to potentially participate in your offerings, right?
Absolutely. You know, we try to design a website that can answer most questions, but of course we always invite people to give us a call. Our toll-free number is on the website, and we'd be more than happy to spend the time to discuss with people what needs or what specific needs they need to address in their lives, and what you know is happening that they might think that they have an addiction or they need treatment. But on the other hand, I also have to say that people that would need our services, right, are people that are already at a point in their lives where they pretty much know that, something is out of control here, and I'm having a really difficult time managing it properly. When you look at an addict or an alcoholic, we say that, you know, they're in denial. But the reality of it is that you can't deny something that you don't already know. And the reason why they're denying it is because they already have a certain sense of awareness that their difficulty in not doing something is causing harm or problems in their lives, and they want to address it, you know.
And they want to address that. That's a great way to look at it. Director of Chatsworth Pavilion, Richard Hoffman, our guest. Again, their website is chatsworthpavilion.com. And again, you don't have to live in Canada or Montreal to take full advantage of their services. Richard, it's a pleasure having you with us on the show. Very empowering and enlightening information. And we look forward to having you back with us on the show very soon, next week. And it's going to be tremendous. I appreciate you being on the show today. I thoroughly enjoyed it. I hope you did as well.
I thank you, Jim. Yes, it's very pleasant, and I appreciate the opportunity to let people know about the program and how we work and the uniqueness of Chatsworth, and I'm very pleased with it. Thank you.
We appreciate it, and enjoy the rest of your day, Richard. And thank you for joining us. This is Jim Masters, Close Up Talk Radio. Enjoy your day. Thanks for joining us.